party, folks.
We're going to open our interim committee on rules, and I want to thank everybody for being here. We have, as you saw the agenda, a number of bills, and this is kind of a first time we've done this, getting ready for the upcoming special session. Having the opportunity to at least hear about some of the bills that are going to be presented, we expect to rules. And I guess I just want to make a couple comments. The one is that when it comes to the three committee bills that we have, so people understand, we can't do anything. There's still LC concepts. They won't become a bill until after the first day of session when we can then introduce them as committee bills. But again, it was really the belief that in order to have a productive session, it's good to have the conversations to begin with now. If there are things that can be done between now and then with respect to amendments and others, it gives us time to work on those things. But it also gives the public an understanding of the kinds of things that are going to be happening with regard to this special session when it comes to policy issues. And so that's what we're about to do. The same is true, except it does give a little advantage in that we have bill numbers actually assigned to those bills that individual members have put forward. And again, those that have been assigned already from the Speaker's office, tentatively assigned to us, we wanted to give them a chance to have a little hearing now so that the public can be expecting what will be coming in the session and kind of open this whole thing up so that people have a better idea of where we're going when the session comes. And it's a good time, since there's very little time during a one-month session, to really fix or get things where we want them. This gives us a couple extra weeks of time between now and then if there's ideas that come forward, but either on the individual members and looking at their bill or the committee bills, to start fine-tuning those things so that it can actually work if it's going to work. So with that, we are going to open, go back to my agenda, a hearing on House Bill 3621, and we'll get a short explanation by our administrator.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 3621 directs DCBS to offer or approve programs to qualify journeyman plumbers or apprentice plumbers in the inspection of cross connections and testing, installation, repair, and maintenance of backflow assemblies. It authorizes that type of plumber who holds certificate to conduct cross-connection inspections, test backflow assemblies, install, repair, maintain assemblies, and engage in other specified activities for which the program has qualified the certificate holder. Beginning July 1, 2011, for backflow assemblies larger than half inch in diameter or serving a structure other than a one or two family dwelling, the tester is required to be a journeyman plumber or apprentice plumber with a certificate issued by the State Plumbing Board.
Okay. For those who don't know, and it's interesting that it came to this committee, it's still interesting that it came to this committee, but rules gets a lot of different bills, and at the end of last session, we had a bill of this nature came here, and one of the commitments that I had made was that I would try to figure out if there was a place in this that could actually work in that, and that's why this is my bill that I put out here. What I want to get on the record for people start understanding, because a number of people last session when we got this said, I have no idea what a backflow device is. And there was really no reason for them to necessarily know what a backflow device is. But it really is a public safety issue, and I think everybody, and I was on the water board, so I did know what backflow devices are. And so today you're going to get a little primer in that for the different groups of people talking about it, and hopefully a conversation about this particular is the first draft. I anticipate that there will be a few little changes, and we'll talk about that as time goes on. So with that, I will call Ron Murray from the Plumbers and Steam Fitters.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Ron Murray, and I represent the United Association of Plumbers and Steam Fitters, and I'll be testifying on their behalf today. Coincidentally, I am the international president of the American Society of Sanitary Engineering, and the American Society of Sanitary Engineering is the standards writing organization in the United States that writes professional qualification standards for backflow devices, medical gas systems, and so forth and so on. Coincidentally, As the president of the American Society of Sanitary Engineering, I hold a seat on the National Board of the American Backflow Prevention Association, so kind of see both sides of this issue. I'm not sure how far you want me to take what a backflow prevention device is, but to make it really, really, really simple, a backflow prevention device is a plumbing device installed by a licensed journeyman plumber under the authority of a plumbing permit, and it's inspected by a plumbing inspector. And what a backflow prevention device does is, unknown to most people, when you know your water comes out of your faucet, and I'll just use your home as an example, the water in that pipe isn't stagnant. It actually moves back and forth, and part of the reason is that, you know, you have water coming out of the ground or into your surface at 42 degrees, and then it may get warmer, and so it expands, and so it goes back and forth. And that there are other features, for example, if you have a water pipe putting water in a pressure boiler, well, it's pretty easy to understand if you have 50 pounds of pressure in the water service, but your boiler is creating 1,000 pounds of pressure, that pressure is going to go someplace, so it's going to go back into the public water system. And the backflow prevention devices are devices that will prevent that. Backflow prevention devices, sometimes they protect the water system at the property line. So anything that happens on that property would not go back to the water service. Typically, you don't see a lot of, they're called premise isolation devices, but there are different degrees of hazard that you are protecting the water supply from. For example, a kidney dialysis machine, it's cooled by water. Well, obviously, if someone is hooked up to a dialysis machine and there's a leak or a broken connection in that machine, you don't want the product in that machine to go back into your public water supply. So the industries that we see a lot of backflow prevention devices on are, of course, manufacturing, high-tech industry, hospitals. You can have 1,000 devices in a hospital because of the degree of contamination that the public water supply could be exposed to. So that's a really a thumbnail sketch of what a backflow prevention device does. The issue that's before you has been a very long-standing issue in the state of Oregon. I personally have worked on it for over 12 years, and we just kind of keep hoping it'll go away, and the time's finally come to fix it. And when the time really came to fix it was about 8 years ago, when Congressman Schrader, probably didn't know he was going to be a congressman then, put together a blue ribbon panel of all the people in this industry. We had 21 people on this panel. It was organized and run by the Department of Human Services, and the testers were on the panel, the plumbers were on the panel, the water service providers were on the panel, everybody was there. And we literally took 18 months and rewrote every single word, and if you can imagine, I'm not exaggerating, in the rules at the Health Division as they related to backflow prevention devices. And when we went to public hearing, even though all the parties were involved, everybody was there, the testers did not agree, and so the project died. And at that point, I think everyone just went to their neutral corners and let things lay. And that's where we are today. So where we are basically today is we were prepared to bring a bill. The plumbing industry was prepared to bring a bill last session. We decided not to do it because, to be honest, the system is broken. It's broken for many different ways. One, the Department of Human Services certainly doesn't have the funding to correct the number one problem in this industry, and that's compliance. They take your money, never to be seen from again. The correct department to oversee this, obviously, is the Building Code Division. They have a plumbing board. They have the funding. This is all, obviously, fiscally neutral. It's just because of the contention between in the industry, it never got there. In the 2000 session, we know that proponents of the legislation that that was brought before you exhibited to you examples of a backflow prevention device, a small backflow prevention device typically used in a one- and two-family dwelling, a half- or three-quarter-inch device. That is not typical for the industry. That's typical for the residential industry. This bill reflects that. This bill gave the proponents of the legislation that you saw everything that they asked for and more. Everything. What this bill basically says is you must be a licensed journeyman plumber to test or repair a backflow device on a commercial structure. The bill needs two small amendments, but one of them will be we're going to take out the word half inch and just install the word residential. In other words, you do not have to be a licensed journeyman plumber to test or repair a backflow device on a residential structure, period. The plumbing industry said, fine, that's what they asked for, that's what we're willing to give them. To take it one step further, when we drafted this, legislative council was made very well aware that we were not to touch the irrigation portion of the system. And they did put in this bill that an irrigation person that installs irrigation systems could install a backflow device on the plumbing system, and that's not correct. So we would amend that out. This bill does not incur any cost to the state of Oregon. It incurs absolutely no additional cost to a licensed journeyman plumber or to anyone else. The statute is specific. For a licensed journeyman plumber right now to test a backflow device, you must take a class. You must take an accredited class. All we did in this bill is specify the criteria of the class, which is the national standard, the ANSI-approved national standard or equivalent. This is not a proprietary bill. It has nothing to do with the unions. It has nothing to do with the non-union. It has to do with public health and safety. And we need to fix this once and for all. And with that, I'll ask if there are any questions.
Representative Jensen.
A couple of things, if I might. Just perhaps the first thing is an observation. If I understood you correctly, you had a group of experts in the industry who worked on this for a considerable period of time who couldn't come to agreement. So you're asking this August group of non-experts here in the legislature to solve the problem that the people in the industry couldn't agree on. Therefore, members, it strikes me that we're being asked to do either a lot of homework or take a lot of things, for granted. But a question, why not on residential? If I understood you again correctly, we're not going to have this licensed plumber or journeyman for residential, regardless of whatever the size of the inlet is. And I know we solved the problem I'm going to present a couple of years ago when we had the meth bill that I sponsored that really cracked down on that. A substantial amount of non-desirable chemicals could be leaked into the water supply if there were no backfill in the residential area. Not that the good folks who make or made meth would necessarily be that worried about conforming to the laws of the state, but I think you understand what my question is.
Yes, sir. Chair Roblin, Representative Jensen, to clarify, when the Blue Ribbon panel was put together, there were 21 people on the panel, and it's tough enough to get this panel to agree on everything, let alone 21. So every segment of the industry selected an individual, and I can tell you who they were. Special districts, because they represented the water districts. Water purveyors, Tualatin Valley Water was seated. The plumbing industry and the testers. And as I said, it was organized by the Oregon Health Division. This panel agreed fully It was a full consensus process. When we walked out of there, we started with a clean sheet of paper. We walked out of there. This panel agreed. This fixes the industry, period. But when it went to public hearing, the opponents, and we make no bones about it, there were catcalls and laughter, and the speakers were shouted down, and this was the people that they represented, and it was one tiny segment of the industry. And that's why we said, we're done. We have given so much of our time to our industry. But the panel itself, the industry experts, they agreed. We had a fix. And basically, the fix is this bill. We didn't bring it to you. I'll be honest, we got exhausted. We worked really hard. So hopefully that cleared that up. The industry experts did agree through a consensus process how to fix it. We have the same people today opposing us. They don't represent, in our opinion, the best interests of the state of Oregon. Secondly, your issue has really to do with public health and safety. And I'll tell you two things. Number one, I've been a licensed journeyman plumber for 35 years. Number two, I'll tell you I'm a retired fire chief and fire medic. So I think I can speak pretty accurately on public safety because I've donated my life to it. I think that your opinion is correct. But I think that to get this bill through, we have to give something. And the only way that we think that we'll be successful in fixing this problem is to simply say we can reduce the costs potentially by allowing non-licensed plumbers to test and repair backflow devices on one and two family. Let me be perfectly clear. It does not change the law for the requirement to have a backflow device. That device can either be installed at the meter, and at a house is typically installed at the meter. Big buildings, it's like at the meter and at the point of use. I think it's because we understand we have to make a trade-off, and that's it.
Current law, the homeowner can repair and fix their backflow device in a residential area now. Is that not true?
Mr. Chair, that's correct, and there's nothing that a journeyman plumber likes more than when you work on your plumbing.
Exactly.
Yeah, we would never, ever, ever prohibit an individual's right to work on their house. That's just a God-given right.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What when you said we hoped this would go away at one point, who was we? I mean,
Chair Roblin, Representative Hanna, I think it was me. in all seriousness, I mean, you know, I've been at lobbying a while, and I'm kind of like at the end of my career. I've been lucky. I've passed some bills. But sometimes it's like, you know, it's like, is this really worth it? You know, you have a group, a small group that's operating under the auspices of the Health Division. You have the rest of the construction industry, and this is a construction issue, and make no bones about it. You have the rest of the industry operating under the building codes. You know as well as I do. The director of the building codes isn't going to rob a program from the Health Division, and the Health Division isn't going to rob a program from building codes. And it's just, I just kind of think, like, after we had gone through the process, we were just like, the system's broke. We know it's broke. Just leave it broke. That may not be, you know, maybe that's not my decision to make, what's the right thing to do. But I just got, I guess I'd say I got tired of fighting it, and now it kind of reared its head and said, we're going to fix it, and that's why I'm here.
Just a follow-up.
Yes. So, I mean, I have backflow prevention devices at home and at our business.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not an expert in the law, but in commercial applications, they have been installed by a licensed plumber.
Mm-hmm.
Help us understand what problem are we solving? Because I've heard you say public safety, but I mean, if these devices are installed by licensed plumbers and they're subsequently inspected, whether that's by a licensed plumber or not, and I'm not sure of that, but I could speak to several applications in the medical field and in the professional production field where they are inspected by professionals because of the nature of the use of the device. I don't personally know of what we're solving. I mean, I haven't seen a public safety issue out of this. What are we solving?
Chair Roblin, Representative Hanna, two things. Yes, you know, you may or may not have a backflow prevention device on your home. I should say people may or may not. You do. I think without question the plumbers are the experts in the industry, and I'm going to tell you why. Local jurisdictions have the authority to dictate whether or not a backflow prevention device is installed on a home. So we had a specific example. As it happens, I can tell you, it was 8 years ago when we had this Blue Ribbon panel meeting, that all of a sudden, people in Pacific City, they had their water heaters were exploding. So what did the plumber do wrong to all of a sudden create this disaster because people's water heaters were exploding? It's because when the local water purveyor mandated a backflow device on the water service, remember the story I told you how water goes back and forth? Well, they'd leave their weekend cabin and the water continually gets warmer and warmer and warmer. Now it has nowhere to go. So what happened? The only place it can go is it popped off the water here. So the plumbers had to write a statute that said any local jurisdiction that mandates a premise isolation backflow prevention device, you must have a licensed plumber now install a thermal expansion tank for some place for that water to go. So the plumbers kind of fixed an inherent problem. Before last legislative session, I contacted the lobbyists for the Oregon Health Division, our Department of Human Services. And I said, we want to introduce a piece of legislation, and this is what the legislation is. In the state of Oregon, there should be absolutely zero testing of backflow prevention devices. None. Because they never fail. Never. In the state of Oregon, backflow prevention devices never fail. And Gail Shibley says, well, I'm not sure that's really true. And I said, I know it's true because I have filed Freedom of Information Act requests from, and I'll tell you, Cannon Beach, Warrenton, Astoria, Tillamook, and I have all these results. And out of 2,000 results, I may have had 10 of these devices fail, whereas the national average on an annual test is about 10%. And I said, so since they never fail, I don't know, maybe it's the water in Oregon, why would we test them? And she says, you're not serious about this, are you? And I said, I'm serious as a heart attack. Why are you making people pay for these tests? There's no compliance program. We all agree there's no compliance program at the Health Division. Why would we require this? And she says, because they're cheating. There's no way to prove that your device was tested. None. You get a receipt. The water purveyor gets a receipt that says your device passed, and then a compilation of that is sent to the Health Division. They go in the cardboard box. What this bill does is it gives the teeth to the Building Code Division, who already has a compliance program, to have follow-up on the testing of these devices. If and consequently, to tell the other side, the Health Division said, well, Ron has a good point here. We can't let this stand. And so they went to another water bureau, and lo and behold, about 10% of the devices failed. Who did they go to? They went to the individual that started the backflow program in the Health Division for the state of Oregon, and he runs a water district in Central Oregon, and he's doing the program right. That's one out of 500. The city of Portland will tell you, we don't monitor this. We send out the notice, and I will tell you, the city of Portland will send out a notice to you if you have a one or two family dwelling and say you are required to have a backflow prevention device tested. And Commissioner Leonard will tell you, what if they don't test it? It's like, they don't follow it up. Well, then why require them to be tested? So what we're saying is we are establishing teeth at no cost to the citizens of the state of Oregon for public health and safety. And it's either like, let's fix this program or do away with it. Obviously, everyone thinks it's broken. Different people have different ideas on how to fix it. We just think this is it. Sir.
Representative Gerard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just want to, I thought I understood you at the beginning, but now I'm much more confused.
I'm sorry.
No. I have a guy comes to my house once a year, single family residence, checks the backflow device,
mm-hmm.
informs the city of Klamath Falls, apparently, that I'm compliant, charges me $25, mm-hmm. and then I see him a year from now. My question to you is, A, is he going to be affected from the standpoint of a failure? Right now, I'm questioning whether, if there was a failure, other than my water heater blowing up, I might not even know it. Who takes the action to hold the tester accountable? In other words, does the same guy who ran the test have to come back and fix it if it's not working?
That's a very fair question. Through the chair, Representative Gerard, currently, if your device fails, your tester, if they are not a licensed journeyman plumber, does not have the authority to repair the device, period. They cannot open that device. So if it's never been repaired, perhaps it's never failed. What this legislation does, and here again, I think I'm trying to weigh public safety with owning a home, how about that, leave it at that. What this legislation will do is the individual that is testing your device will be able to repair it. It will give the tester the authority to repair it on your home. Now, this legislation does not give the health division compliance authority. So you're still on your own on that one. On Representative Hanna's commercial structure, if there is a problem with that test or repair, obviously there's recourse. It's through the building code division, and actually we're hearing another bill too. They can go after the journeyman plumber's license and revoke that license. When we talk about compliance, the State of Oregon Health Division has had one compliance case brought before them in the last 5 years. One. And there's hundreds of thousands of these devices out there. I can tell you that in the Building Code Division, I have filed a complaint against a backflow tester who was illegally repairing devices in the Bearden School Districts, and we prevailed on 83 counts of violating the work of a journeyman plumber. 83 counts in a school. And the gentleman says, but we didn't do it. And I says, is that your name at the bottom where you said you repaired it? And he goes, well, yeah. And I go, well, I'm not a lawyer, but I'd say that's a prima facie case. You can't fix these. You're not trained to do it. You're not certified to do it. And you legally can't do it. That's the difference kind of between the Building Code Division, where there is a process already for compliance. I mean, it's already set up, and the health division. So that's part of the reason we want to move it to the building.
But one quick follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Yep.
If I can remember what it is now.
I'm sorry if I'm lengthy.
No. Is my guy in Klamath, when we heard this originally, there was word that the plumbers didn't want to do this. And you were going to, if you had to call a plumber to come look at your backflow device, you're going to sit there for 6 months waiting for it to happen. Can you respond?
I'd love to answer that. Representative Roland.
I'm sorry I asked it then.
Yeah. Well, let me tell you. I've got 350 plumbers on the out-of-work list. I am employing apprentice plumbers that have been out of work that haven't had a job for 8 months to cut wood and stack wood at my house, to mow my lawn. Because they can't get a job in the state of Oregon. So I'll tell you, licensed journeyman plumbers are pretty willing to work on your backflow device. Okay. And that is erroneous when anyone tells you that the journeyman plumber is not willing to test a backflow device. I got my backflow tester certificate 30 years ago. It's part of our trade. They're willing to do it.
Okay. Thank you for a very direct response.
Thank you for the question.
Any further questions? And we'll have more time with this as time goes on. Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
So now, Christina McNitt and Jill.
Hyanga.
And Kate. Madam Moore. And thanks for making it so quickly without much warning.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members, for the record, my name is Christina McNitt, and I represent the Oregon Backflow Testers Association, which is a group comprised of backflow testing service providers and customers, which include DHS-certified testers, trainers, plumbers, and water purveyors. And with me to my far right is Kate Matamore. She is a partner in a backflow management company and a training company, and Jill Hoyanga, who is the water management services supervisor for the Eugene Water and Electric Board. Again, thank you for this opportunity, and we really do see House Bill 3621 as an opportunity, not quite written yet in a way that we would embrace, but we see this as a real extension of effort on behalf of Representative Roebland to seek compromise between the service provider community about who can provide inline repairs. There was a discussion earlier, Representative Garrard, in your district. It may be interesting for you to know that 12 counties out of 36 in Oregon don't even have a plumber who's also DHS certified to test their own repair. So what that means in the real life scheme of things is that if you on an annual basis you have your backflow assembly tested, say it's one of the rare ones that fails, that DHS certified tester is not allowed, as they were prior to 1993, is no longer allowed to make that repair. Instead, they have to inform the water purveyor, in this case that would be Jill's shop at eWeb, and they have to inform the homeowner that they need to call a plumber to come test the repair, make the repair. At that point, depending on whether or not the plumber is also DHS certified to test their own repair, the homeowner is in the situation where they may have to call out another tester. So you can imagine they think that there's a whole scheme going on. And if 12 counties don't even have certified or plumbers who are certified testers, then that is really difficult from the consumer perspective. So our goal really is to get more service providers in the industry. We welcome plumbers to become DHS certified testers and would like more of them. I think that would relieve some of the pressure that we're feeling, particularly in rural areas. I'll just remind you that our concept during the last session would be to allow DHS-certified testers to do inline repairs. And you'll probably fondly recall Big Bertha, which I was hauling around to all of your offices, which is a backflow assembly device. It's a 3/4-inch device. They can range up to 2 feet, 1 foot.
It was a 1-inch.
It was a 1-inch assembly. My point is they can be the size that I was carrying around, which made my left shoulder numb for weeks at a period of time, to very, very, very large. But the internal components are pretty much the same except for the tension on the springs. An inline repair, which is, from our perspective, quite a compromise to begin with, because prior to 1993, repairs were all over the gamut, from replacing an assembly to doing opening the components, flushing it, replacing the O-rings, and putting it back to specified manufacturer standards. Inline repair would limit the repair in statute, our concept was, to opening it, flushing it, and maybe replacing an O-ring, some of those parts. That's it. If there's freeze damage or cracking or some way the tester cannot repair with that maneuver, then a plumber would, again, be called out to the premise. So Representative Roebland has been instrumental in moving the discussion forward because he suggested in post-legislative conversations that maybe inline repair would be a concept worth pursuing if there was a size limit on the pipe. And so we are excited to be here looking at this legislation as a vehicle in February to maybe talk about what type of inline repair would apply to what size pipe. I welcome Mr. Murray's comments about about compliance and reporting. We'd be happy to talk about those things. We are open and eagerly awaiting an honest and straightforward conversation around a table with a variety of stakeholders so we can tease these issues out and bring something to you in a final document in this bill for February's consideration. And with that, I'll pass the baton.
Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. My name is Jill Hoyenka. Again, I'm from the Eugene Water and Electric Board. My work group takes care of water conservation and cross-connection control for the Eugene Water and Electric Board service area. I want to thank you particularly, Representative Roblin, for sponsoring this bill. And I look forward to the stakeholder conversation to bring all the stakeholders together in the interest of protecting public health. I have 4 points. I wanted to point out that our water purveyor interest, water purveyors in general, not just Eugene Water and Electric Board, we would like to maintain the current State of Oregon cross-connection program because it is considered to be one of the most effective programs of its kind in the country. We would like to maintain a single standard test procedure for all tests performed in the state of Oregon, as there is now. We would like to return the drinking water program to its original authority for testing and repair of backflow prevention assemblies, same day in-line repair for most or all backflow assemblies provide maximum protection for public health. And when I say most or all, what I mean is sometimes the parts are not available that day. We try to make sure that it is. In fact, our utility carries parts in case a tester finds themselves short of stock, and the distributors are also short of stock. The fourth point is that water purveyors are interested in fostering a respectful partnership among all stakeholders that are interested in protecting public health through cross-connection control. I have some supporting material. I have a tabulation of certified testers that are available on the DHS website. And when I looked into that, I found this statistic about how there weren't as many plumbers available as we would like that are trained. I also have some statistics about the failure rates, and that's also from DHS information, and that's updated from the last memo that this committee received, because at that time there was only 2007 information available, and now I have 2008 information. I also provided some information about the University of Southern California Foundation for Cross-Connection Control and Hydraulics Research. 14 times fast. And the reason I included that is because a testing and repair program has been the best practices recommended by USC since their initial publication of their manual in 1960. It also is the referenced in the State of Oregon Administrative Rules for DHS as the testing procedures and also for approving backflow assemblies. Also wanted to point out that licensed plumbers and professional testers receive the same training by statute. That's a reminder from the last time that we were before this committee, and I wanted to provide that again for you to look at and to emphasize. Thank you very much for providing the opportunity to bring these stakeholders together. Water utilities spend a lot of energy treating water, conveying water, and it's very important to us to have this inline repair allowed by testers so that we can have same-day repair, to facilitate same-day repair so that the water quality has less of a chance of being compromised. Thank you for your time.
Mixed. Yes, you're like a tag team here. Okay, my name is Catherine Matamor, and I'm the co-owner, as was said before, of Backflow Management, which is a training and consulting business. We train backflow assembly testers and we are one of three approved training agencies in Oregon. I'm also here to represent the Oregon Backflow Testers Association and to provide testimony about this repair issue and answer any questions. Also, as a footnote, I used to work for the DHS drinking water program, the cross-connection program, so I could answer some questions about that if you had any. Oregon Backflow Testers Association appreciates the opportunity that this committee has allowed our organization, Backflow Assembly Testers, and the public water systems to explain really the primary focus that we have and the importance of this issue, which really still resides with public health. We realize that this bill as presented today is a work in progress intended by the sponsors to bring the testers and the water systems and the plumbers together to work out a compromise. Simple is best, and we hope to focus on the issue, which is allowing backflow assembly testers to perform simple inline repairs of failing assembly, most likely to be repaired by flushing and cleaning the components, and then in some cases also the replacement of the internal modular parts. A lot of cases, really, it's just a matter of opening it up and flushing, because there is debris in the water, and it does get caught in the components of a backflow assembly. So sometimes it's just as simple as cleaning it, you know, not really changing anything out. And we know that these assemblies are protecting known health hazards to a public water system and then returning them to the original manufacturer specifications when they retest it. As a consumer, allowing backflow assembly testers to perform these simple repairs means, you know, really one visit, less environmental impact. Assemblies are cleaned or restored at a significantly lower cost to the consumer than a plumber visit that would most likely replace the entire assembly. Please be aware that the repair of assemblies is currently allowed and working in many more situations than was mentioned earlier. Homeowners is just one of them. Landscape contractors are allowed to actually install, repair, maintain, replace backflow assemblies on irrigation or water features only. Employees of companies working on their employer's assemblies. So when you get to, you know, like a big industrial, you know, application, you'll find that there's in-house people, in-house maintenance workers, not necessarily plumbers that are doing this type of work. And anyone right now can repair standalone irrigation systems or standalone fire systems because under the plumbing rules, they're made of non-potable piping. Therefore, that's not something that the plumbers has jurisdiction over. So anybody can do repairs on those as it stands and has been, you know, as it stands right now. And then also the water systems, they maintain their own assemblies on their own systems, and that's also been working. So there's really quite a few categories where this has historically been working. So, and then just to let you know that as a training agency, that the backflow assembly testers do continue to receive training on diagnosing failures and performing repairs. This is actually in the rules, the Oregon Administrative Rules, as it sits, and that is the way that the training agencies, you know, train the testers. This issue has been simmering since the 1990s when testers lost the ability to perform repairs. It's time to work this issue out by compromise. We do thank the Oregon Backflow Testers Association does thank the representative, Arnie Roblin, for his support and understanding of this repair issue. I think in part because you are, you know, associated with the water, you know, district. I think that really has made quite an impact. And we do thank this committee for allowing us to come forward and provide testimony. We are, in this industry, we really are eager to come to compromise and to, you know, to work this out.
Any questions? The only one I had, and it's one that has always been a part of my thinking on this whole idea, is the idea that I want to make sure that in the final analysis I have safe water. And I think that's the impact for everybody. And so you find a problem, maybe it's just cleaning out a little debris, and that's all it needs to do to fix the device. My concern is, how does that get reported back to find out why it got in there in the first place? I mean, I there shouldn't be any debris in my water system. And if there is, there's a part of me that says, I'd like to know that a plumber or somebody else went and looked at that to make sure that maybe there's a bigger problem than just what happened there. And how do we go about with training testers to do that? I mean, it's the idea, you know, do you go to an optometrist or an ophthalmologist or, I mean, all of those different kinds of things, depending on what illnesses there may be in the family, you know, what are the things that you want to be looking for as opposed to just the surface problem?
Right.
How do we make sure that if there's a problem that might be bigger than just cleaning that O-ring, it gets reported back to fix the whole system?
Representative Roblin, if I may. I think that a majority of repairs actually occur right after installation because obviously the pipe is cut into and maybe it wasn't flushed, you know, properly when it was, you know, put back together. There's been instances of like Teflon tape catching, you know, fouling into the checks and things like that. Actually, you know, cleaning after an initial installation is very common. And I think that's why, is because there was a break in the pipe. You know, other times it could be maintenance work from the water system that allows debris in. I mean, there can be debris that comes from internal plumbing, you know, rather than necessarily coming from the water system itself, such as corrosion within the pipes, you know, breaking loose, that type of thing, depending on the type of pipes. You know how galvanized pipe tends to constrict with rust. So things like that are, it's going to be a component. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's bad water. I mean, I would rather have a nice pebble than some medical waste in my pipes, so given the choices.
Okay. Any other questions? No. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Ron would like to come up and say a word as well, and maybe this will get the conversation going. So that's my hope.
Mr. Chair.
Yes. Right. One more second.
Yeah,
Representative Berger.
Christina, could you make your handouts available by email to us?
My handout by email to you?
Can you send them to us in a digital format for the sake of
that.
Our staff so they don't have to scan them in when they
it looks like that's a popular request.
Okay.
We're getting everything online. We're going paperless around here, so it would be helpful at times to get
our staff would bless you.
Okay.
Because otherwise we take them back and say scan this.
Okay. Thanks. Yeah, you did. You did.
Representative Roland, members of the committee, thank you for indulging me, and I hope you don't think I'm long-winded. A couple of factual things I would like to bring up. They are correct. The Department of Human Services does not have a list of licensed journeyman plumbers that are licensed by the DHS in the 12 southern counties of the state of Oregon. And the reason for that is they don't have to be. I know. I wrote the law. A licensed journeyman plumber that completes a backflow testing training class as part of their apprenticeship program does not have to be certified by the Department of Human Services. Why would they be? Now you're going to have to pay a license to the Building Code Division and a certification to the Department of Human Services. That's why we wrote the law. It's ludicrous. So you won't see any plumbers on that list. The University of Southern California was brought up in this. The most stringent backflow test in the United States is the American Society of Sanitary Engineering one-year field test. I flew in last night from Phoenix, Arizona, where there are palm trees, to come here today. We were testifying on this issue in Arizona. It's like the ASSC standard, which is identified in this bill, is the most stringent standard. And lastly, this legislation gives them the inline repair, and it's just like they said, you know, and the argument was, if they have the inline repair that doesn't work, they have to call the plumber. What this legislation says, on a one and two family, they can fix the thing and they're done. You don't have to bring the plumber back. That was the intent. So that was where the compromise was made, is the tester can go out and do the whole thing right there. So lastly, and I think you'll see in almost all building code legislation, doesn't matter if it's electrical, sheet metal, plumbing or whatever, HVAC, government entities, manufacturers, they all have the right to do their own in-house repair. It has to be done under a permit. I mean, if you had a bathroom at Intel, they can do it in-house. They have to get a permit to do it, though. But we always exempt that. That's goes back to the God-given right to screw up your own stuff. So that's not really even an issue here. And lastly, when we talk about debris and a backflow prevention device, there's what the tester can't do is fix it, and the reason for it is the Uniform Plumbing Code that states that on the installation of a backflow prevention device, you must have a device ahead of it to keep out the dirt and debris. It's called a Y strainer. That's so you don't have to go back and fix them. So we actually think that's in place. But I just kind of wanted to clarify those points up if I can answer any questions and bore you with plumbing. So.
Well, thank you, Ron. We'll
thank
talk
you
to you
again.
Some more. We'll continue to have a conversation. So we'll close that public hearing on, go back to my numbers.
3621.
And we're going to open a hearing on two, because they have some similarities. House Bill 3638 and Legislative Concept 158. So we'll open both of those at the same time, so if people want to talk to one or the other, they can. And Representative Hannah, do you want to go out there or you want to sit there? Whichever you want to do.
I'm good from either spot.
Wherever you feel comfortable.
All right, I'll just stay right here then. You ready to go?
Anyone else has signed up? You're ready to go.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, members, audience. My name is Bruce Hanna. I'm a state representative from House District 7. I appreciate you taking the time to consider House Bill 3638, which is an ethics reform bill that will help restore Oregonians' confidence in their legislature. I introduced this bill so Oregonians are assured that legislators are not using their position within the legislature to obtain higher-paying state jobs. Oregonians are naturally and understandably cynical about potential conflicts of interest in that area of their legislators and state government. Legislators have extraordinary power in their positions to help shape public policy and control the billions of dollars that are spent by state government and those dollars sent in by taxpayers. Whenever members leave their low-paying jobs in the legislature for higher-paying jobs in the executive branch, the members' personal, financial, and political motivations can be questioned. To eliminate any doubt, I am proposing that we impose a waiting period on legislators before they can seek and obtain these salaried, non-elected positions in the executive branch. Specifically, House Bill 3638 prohibits a former member of the Legislative Assembly from receiving a salary for serving as a public official in state government during the period beginning on the date the person ceases being a member and ending on the date of adjournment, sine die, of the next regular session. Gets a little complicated, but really it's not terribly complicated because it emulates what we have done before. This bill is simply an extension of the law we passed in 2007 to require legislators to wait before they can become lobbyists. In fact, House Bill 3638 simply adds a new subsection to that statute. After all, if we're going to ban or temporarily ban legislators from seeking certain positions in the private sector, it makes sense that we should also temporarily ban them from seeking those similar positions within the public sector. I don't believe it is appropriate for legislators to seek an agency job at the same time they have considerable influence over an agency's policies and budget. A waiting period would simply assure that legislators can't use their position to win lucrative state jobs, and it guarantees they would not be able to leverage their power and insider connections to get what they were hoping for. Best of all, it forces legislators to compete with unemployed Oregonians and or other qualified applicants for these state positions. A mandatory waiting period may be the only way we can assure a fair process for hiring people or promoting current employees within an agency. I appreciate that the chair and the committee recognize the problem and are considering a separate bill to address the hiring process. However, I believe this concept does not go far enough to mitigate Oregonians' concerns about the conflict of interests, that legislators would still be allowed to job hunt state jobs while they are in office, and that legislators would still be able to move quickly to the executive branch, raising the same questions that we have seen brought to us after the 2009 session. The only way to completely eliminate conflicts of interest is to require a legislator to leave office and wait until the end of the next legislative session to take an agency job. I believe next month when we meet, we need to send that strong message that the legislature is about public service, not about using the office as a stepping stone to state employment. respectfully request that you consider House Bill 3638 and move it forward so we may pass it in February. And I appreciate the opportunity to bring that to you.
Any questions? Representative Gelser.
I have a question, which is why I raised my hand.
That's right.
So what happens when you have a legislator that prior to serving in legislative service worked for an agency? I worked for the Department of Human Services before I came here, left that position because you can't serve in both an executive branch or others. We have members here who may be qualified that may retire from service, enter the job pool in the same way as everyone else, apply on a website. Is it really appropriate to completely ban legislators for 2 years after that from returning to the type of employment that they had before coming, if there are appropriate safeguards to ensure that they are competing with others and application is made after they have left the legislative office?
I think the expectation Oregonians have is that a legislator should not be able to use their position of influence in dealing with agency policy and or budget that might also give them an unfair advantage in employment. So as this bill would be written, you would be prohibited until the end of the next end of session, sine die.
Can I follow up?
Yes.
Couldn't you accomplish the same means if the bill were to say that a legislator could not seek employment, and you talked about seeking employment while they had that influence, mm-hmm. until after they had retired, therefore they would not be eligible for any position that was posted prior to their leaving service. If they have already left, if they are out of service before they even begin application for these positions, I guess I don't understand how that influences use. Once we leave this building, we have no influence.
Well, I might suggest differently in that if you were a member of Ways and Means or the co-chair and you had significant influence over budget and or policy and you decided to retire, you still may have had enough influence during that time period, whether or not you were applying or not during that time period. But I mean, nothing prohibits any of us from retiring today before the end of our session or our term of service. So I think you could still have significant influence in an agency and or its budget, and under your scenario, nothing would prevent you from the next month be working there. So, I mean, I guess if you thought starting a new program within an agency was critically important and you had the kind of influence that it takes, and I hope none of us have that much, that we could implement that new policy and you knew enough people in the agency that you had a pretty good opportunity to get a job there, you retire from your legislative position, and the next month you could be over there running that department. And I think this is trying to prevent that exact thing from happening.
I think the question that I have, and as you look at a change in this legislature in terms of the age of people that are serving, and you are talking about positions at lower levels, I understand the issue that you're trying to get at, and I think it's very important that there never be undue influence that is used to get a position, and I believe that's why the chair has brought forward that other legislative concept. On the flip side, I don't know that the consequence of stepping up to serve should be that we shut off opportunities for people in public service to continue to apply for jobs in order to support their families later on. I just think that there's a middle ground in there somewhere. This seems relatively draconian and going beyond the points that you've laid out.
Well, I would point out that it exactly emulates what we have said legislators can't do into the private sector. So if you believe it's draconian from this point to leave the legislature and go into public service, probably we ought to take a look at it going the other way as well.
And I think that I see that as a difference. If you're coming back into private service as a lobbyist, you have existing relationships within the building which you could leverage to move forward policies that change the entire state. I think someone applying to be a food stamp worker is, it's a very different type of circumstance in terms of how those connections would be used. You're going to process the food stamp applications the same way that you did previously.
Well, I don't want to discount what a food stamp worker may do or their value, because it could be vast. However, in examples we have seen, that has not been the level of employment legislators have been seeking, that I think causes the public to have some degree of mistrust in the process.
Could I interject something here?
Representative Berger.
The issue is the same. Why couldn't a retired legislator, food stamp worker, use their influence within this body, if they are newly out of this body, in the same way a retired legislator would use it as a lobbyist? Do you see what I'm saying? If it is a problem that you leave here, have relationships, and can't walk into lobbying because of it, it is also a problem that you leave here, have relationships, and walk into state government. It is what I think this legislation speaks to. Now, if you want to draw some lines on level of influence of the job, I think I'd be willing to look at that. But as one who objected to the lobby revolving door law because it was, you know, discriminatory for the wrong reasons, and the argument was made vehemently, I was in the room, well, you've got these relationships. Well, the same is true in this instance. You walk out of this building with relationships within this building that influence state government in a significant way if you go to work for an agency. So in the same way that if you went to work as a lobby. Okay, so if it's the relationships that are the issue, it works both ways. Now, I understand what you're saying. You don't want to hurt somebody's ability to work in their chosen field after they leave this building. And I think that there may be some way to get there within this. But I guess I'm looking at this with a history of being in the work group that looked at the revolving door law and thought it was just patently the wrong way to go. And since we can't repeal that, let's make it fair across the board. And I am sensitive to what you're saying. If you are qualified as something and you were qualified walking in, are you less qualified walking out? There is a sort of cost to public service in this building of having to be really squeaky clean on your way out the door.
And I would agree, you have to be really squeaky clean on the door. Again, the argument that I would make the difference between a lobbyist and a food stamp, I'm not making an argument about the relative value of either of those positions, but a person that is lobbying trades, I mean, they trade in the value of those relationships to influence people in the building with whom they have those services. A person who is processing food stamp applications, I think it would be a violation of their employment terms to come and advocate on behalf of the Department of Human Services. They're people that do that for them. I just think there are unintended consequences that we should look at. What about foster care? Would that mean that a qualified foster care provider, you could be a foster family while you're serving in the legislature, but once you leave, you are precluded from taking foster kids into your home because then you're receiving payments from an executive agency. I just think that there are consequences there that are different than what you are trying to get at.
Like payments from a state agency and being a state employee are very separate.
I hope we can get there.
Other questions on that one? I guess what I would say is the other one to look at is make sure you've looked over LC 158 because when we come back, it's one of those that will probably be introduced. And I think that maybe it is a combination of the two and looking at those to figure out where we're going. This one basically says you really have to be qualified for the position. It has to be posted. You have to have a certain number of people who have applied and so on so that we know that there's a pool. looking at the same issue, but from a different way of getting there, that would acknowledge that if you did have all the qualifications and you were the one selected, that might be done. So I again, would like to look at it. Yes. Representative Jensen.
No, I didn't want to interrupt.
Okay, I'm done. Oh, I'm good.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I find the arguments being offered by, if I may, both parties to have merit. One thing that I kind of liked that somebody seemed to have hinted at was maybe we shouldn't have any restrictions on any of these.
That was my suggestion.
I quite frankly wasn't real enthused with the original legislation that came through with its restrictions, and I'd feel a little bit of what sauce for the goose is, excuse me, is sauce for the gander type of thing, which goes one way, you know, should go the other. I dislike the idea that any place where we might have a highly qualified person, whether that's being coming into the legislature or from the legislature going out, that can do an exemplary job in whatever the area is, that they be denied, you know, the opportunity to do that for what, you know. But I do understand the point that the representative from Southern Oregon, I guess he called it Southern Oregon, is making. I'd have difficulty not supporting it as long as we continue to have the thing going the other way. I'm sorry, as the closing line in George G. Scott's movie, The Hospital, I'm sorry you just happen to have life membership in an imperfect society.
Any other questions, concerns, comments on either of these two? Okay, then we will close our public hearings on House Bill 3638 and Legislative Concept 158. And now we're going to open a hearing on Legislative Concept 179 relating to county surveyors. And Charles Gibbs, Midland County Surveyor, is here. I should bring it just for you.
You have a few extra documents there, Representative Chair, and committee members there.
Yep, there we go.
I'm Charles Gibbs. I'm the Linn County Surveyor. I'm also the president of the OASIS, Oregon Association of County Engineers and Surveyors. And I'm also a professional land surveyor member of PLSO. This bill, draft 179, is necessary, and Senate Bill 344 caused a few problems for us. It's made a lot of the county surveyors from elected to appointed, and I have a little history there of how Oregon actually had county surveyors from 1854, and that was through the legislation passed in 1854. And in 1859, Oregon Constitution also reaffirmed that the county surveyor was an elected position. And that's part of the problem with Senate Bill 344, is it caused a lot of problems with us county surveyors that were elected. In 1958, Oregon made the home rule charters, and since 1968, nine of the counties have become home rule charters, and they can appoint a county surveyor without having to have an election. They can just appoint them. There's four counties that actually had votes of the public that made county surveyors appointed. The rest of them, 23, are all general law counties, and we go through the process of having a vote every 4 years for our positions. I have been the county surveyor in Linn County since 2003, and being the county surveyor and the president of OASIS, the members have asked me to come and present this to you that, yes, this is a good change on LC 179, and we're very much in favor of it. There's some other issues that we'd like to work on later, but that's the main one, the nonpartisan issue. I have passed an ordinance in Linn County, our commissioners did, to keep me as an elected county surveyor. A number of the other counties have done that as well. I'm not sure exactly how many now. We have a meeting at the end of this month, OASIS meeting, and they will tell me what everybody has done. That's part of our agenda to find out. But the main thing is that we really want to get this changed to where it is a nonpartisan position back, because of Senate Bill 3044 changed that on the Oregon statutes, the 209.002 and 254.005. Those are the ones that changed in that, taking the county surveyor out of the nonpartisan positions. Anyway, that's my thing, is I'm in favor of that, and I hope that you will get this LC 179 through the legislature to get that corrected. If there's any questions, I'm glad to answer them.
Representative Berger.
Fundamentally, you want it to be an elected office, but you don't want to have to go through two elections.
Well, that's part of it, Representative Roblin, Chair, and Berger. Yes, I don't want to have to go through two elections. Usually, I have been run unopposed. The county surveyors before me, there's only been a couple of them that have had somebody that ran opposed to them. But it's been nonpartisan all this time. And if we went into being partisan, then we would have to say we're a Democrat or we're a Republican or we're whatever. And it just costs a lot more money for the county to advertise for this and do other. There's been no problem all along with that. There's many of us that there are some complacent people that don't do anything. They don't participate, but I'm not one of those. I want to keep with the public and being able to get votes from the public.
Follow up. Yes.
I'll be quite frank with you. I'm one of those that don't believe this should be an elected position, period.
Yeah.
Okay. We have enough contentious elected positions, so you and I would probably not agree on that. That being said, I agree. You know, why is it controversial? Why should it be partisan? And why should it be elected is the way I would go down this argument. Have you or your organization have any recent data on how many of these positions have actually been opposed in, say, the last? And is it a four-year term, two-year term?
It's a four-year term. Yes.
In say the last 8 years or two cycles of these counties, how many do you keep statistics on how many are contested?
I don't have that information. I just know that in Linn County, I have not been opposed.
Yeah, I would question whether anybody ever opposes, and making it nonpartisan will kind of ensure that probably not. But I remain one that believes this should not be an elected official, and will talk. I kind of agree. It'd be so much easier if you didn't have to. I kind of feel the same way about my own election. Thank you.
Other comments? When I first had a conversation with people about this bill, it was clear to me that, from my perspective, when we voted on the other bill, I didn't realize the implication of not having these in here. And so to me, it was more of an oversight. I think counties should make the decision about whether they should be elected or not elected. That we should leave up to the counties. But if there is going to be election, I think nonpartisan is the best way. Most of our counties are moving to nonpartisan county commission races, and vote after vote is coming out that way. And so if we're going to have a vote, because I'm not sure that we need to have a vote on this either, I think qualifications and other things should select a surveyor. But if we are, I think this is the right way to go. So, and not wanting to take things away from counties that have already made decisions how they want to run this, I'd probably let them be that way. But it is strange to me that this is a fairly technical job, that we aren't going out and trying to hire the best technician as opposed to electing someone. Now, we do have to have qualifications when you run, so that's that does help.
Mr. Chair, one of the things you asked about was running on a post. The two county surveyors before me did run against somebody in their elections, and it was the same person. Sometimes county surveyors and private surveyors in that county or adjacent counties that do survey work there do not get along.
Oh, I'm shocked.
So, you know, we have some authority, but we go by Oregon statutes, and we follow the statutes. A lot of private surveyors sometimes don't want to do that, and they have headbutting with us. But, you know, most of the time I try to help. The county surveyor helps the private surveyors and the private people to settle differences and whatnot. And I've always tried to be that way. So I don't really have any people that want my job. You know, it doesn't pay as well as what they make in private. I used to be a private land surveyor, and I had to take a cut in pay to go to work for the county, but I, of course, make more now than I did then. But that's the issue, is that if you're a good county surveyor, you don't have people running against you. They want you to be there to help them. There are some people that if they got in the office, they would not be very good people to work with, and with private surveyors and with the public and with the other county departments. You know, I get along great with my county departments. I don't have any problems with them. The commissioners wanted me to stay elected. Some of my friends who are other county surveyors that are appointed say, well, if you were appointed, you get paid better. And I says, well, yes, maybe, but I don't have the freedom to go on vacation when I want to go on vacation or some of the other issues that come up. But I'm there all the time. I actually work more hours than I'm paid for, you know, most of the time, because I'm that kind of a person. I want to be there to help people and make sure things are done right. So anyway, I appreciate your giving me the opportunity to speak in front of you, and I'd really like to get this passed through if we could.
Any other questions for this witness? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
And because we've gone through this process, it's getting into the system. I look forward to this being on that first day or so, at least being introduced as a committee bill, and then we'll go from there.
Thank you.
Yep. So we're going to close our hearing on LC 179, and we'll open a hearing on LC 207. And Paul Snyder with AOC is here, so we'll invite Paul up. And again, as I have said repeatedly, these will still stay legislative drafts until we get there in the first day, and then some, if not all, and there may be others that come up between now and then that the speaker sends this way that would be committee bills that we'll look at.
Future.
With that, Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Paul Snyder, representing the Association of Oregon Counties. I'd first like to thank you for considering Legislative Concept 207 and for this chance to testify about it. LC 207 relates to a law. The law is contained in ORS Chapter 105. And it has to do with a law that extends immunity to landowners for allowing the public to use their land for particular purposes. And the reason for the bill has to do with an opinion of the Oregon Supreme Court that was issued in September of last year on a 4-3 vote. And it's creating some problems with respect to parks and, I believe, with respect to private landowners as well. So I'd like to explain a little bit about it. This series in ORS Chapter 105 was enacted in 1995. It repealed a whole bunch of other statutes, so my guess is, although I don't know, that it's a revision of previous law. It includes a public policy statement. That statement says that it's the policy of the state to encourage owners of land to make their land available to the public for recreational purposes, for wood cutting, and for the harvest of special forest products by limiting their liability toward persons entering thereon for such purposes and protecting their property interests. I'm paraphrasing. This brings us to a lawsuit, Coleman versus Oregon Parks and Recreation Department, decided by the Supreme Court in September of last year on a 4-3 vote. And the facts are these, that the Colemans came to Tugman State Park and they were camping there. The park charges a camping fee, but it also has a rather large day use area for which the state doesn't charge any fee. Anybody can use that part of the park anytime they want without charge. And Mr. Coleman and a friend went from the campgrounds on their mountain bikes over to the part of the park where there are trails and there is a wooden bridge. He crossed the bridge by taking his bicycle and lifting it onto the bridge because it didn't have a ramp on that side, went over to the other side, came back again, went over the ramp that wasn't there on the other side, and got injured coming back again. And he sued the state, and the state of Oregon raised the defense of recreational immunity under the statute. And it was on summary judgment motion, and so the state moved for summary judgment in its favor. The trial court granted it. The Court of Appeals agreed with the trial court. The Supreme Court took a look at the case and said, let's take a look at legislative intent, and we think that it should have a different result. The Supreme Court focused on a couple provisions in the law. One is the phrase to enter or go upon the owner's land. There is a definition of charge. If you charge for this particular use, then you lose the immunity. Or if you charge more than what's allowed, you lose the immunity. So it depends on the particular activity. In the case of recreational activities, if you charge at all, you lose the immunity for that particular activity. And the Supreme Court's majority opinion said, in terms of charge, you charge for the use of the land. And so, therefore, you've lost recreational immunity. The state said, we didn't charge for that part of the park. We charged for the camping part of the park. And we didn't charge for bicycling or the use of the trails. We charged for camping. And the Supreme Court majority opinion said, well, no, that just doesn't work. You've charged for the use of the land. The state responded by saying, well, but look, if we have, suppose you've got a landowner with 100 acres of land, and it's got 10 acres devoted to equestrian uses, and you charge for the equestrian area on the 10 acres, but you don't charge anybody for the 90 acres. It would seem absurd to say that someone who's injured on the 90 acres, for which you make no charge whatsoever, has a claim when basically you've not charged for that part of the land that you own. The Supreme Court majority said, well, maybe. We're not going to answer that question right now because there's nothing in the record of your summary judgment motion that says that you've put up signage or that you have fences up or some other way to tell when you've left the campground and you've gone to the other part of the park. The dissent said this, and I'd just like to emphasize three or four sentences.
I didn't mention it today.
They said, in this case, the majority holds that if a landowner charges a fee for the use of one part of its land, the landowner may not assert recreational immunity as to a user who pays the fee, even for injuries that occur on other land that is open for recreational use without charge. In my view, the interpretation is not supported by the statutory wording and will significantly limit the immunity that the legislature intended to confer on landowners who make their land available to the public for recreational purposes. As a result, the legislature's policy choice will be thwarted. And what LC 207 seeks to do is to basically clarify and respond in a fashion that the dissent has pretty much said itself. And it does that in two ways. It says that if you charge for a particular recreational use, then your immunity still applies to the other uses for which you don't charge. And if you charge for the use of a particular portion of the land, the recreational immunity still applies to the part of the land for which you didn't charge. And this applies not just obviously in the case of public bodies, but it also applies in the case of private landowners. And the recreational uses for which the legislature intended to confer this immunity includes hunting, fishing, swimming, boating, camping, picnicking, hiking, nature study, outdoor educational activities, water skiing, winter sports, viewing or enjoying historical, archaeological, scenic, or scientific sites, or volunteering for any public purpose project. Our concern with the way the court has left the situation now is, first of all, they haven't said whether if you put up signs it's going to make a difference. And they haven't said whether or not you designate particular areas one way or another that it would make a difference. They just said we're remanding it because we don't need to get to that issue. I suggest that that leaves landowners in a situation that's basically untenable. Why would a landowner allow people to go hunting on his or her land and go to the trouble of designating a particular area and say, okay, you can hunt here, but you can't hunt there. You can fish here, but you can't fish there. You can do archaeological review of areas here, but you can't go rock climbing there, without even knowing whether that's going to continue to protect the landowner under the recreational immunity provision of the law. And so we think that LC-207 deals with that issue pretty well. It addresses the situation that others have raised, and maybe even the dissent did too. If you had somebody who was doing exactly the same activity in the same part of the park, but who didn't go camping before they went bicycling, that person is subject to the immunity statute, but the person who went camping is not subject to the immunity statute. Where's the logic in that? I'm not sure that that's the result that would obtain, but that's one of the concerns that have been raised, and given the logic that was expressed by the majority opinion, it could very well result that way. So we recommend LC-207 to basically, we think, put the statute back in the area where we believe the legislature intended it to be, and that is to encourage landowners to allow the public to use their land, and in return for that, it provides us recreational immunity.
Questions? Yes, Representative Berger.
Couple, if you'll indulge me.
Yes.
Was it a county park? Is that why this is coming from the counties?
That was a state park.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, it was a state park.
And why is this coming from the counties?
We have the same problem.
The reason that I ask this question is that I've been here long enough to see how a simple fix turns into a can of worms. Okay, and I'm very concerned that in trying to fix something that the courts were not very clear on what the fix was, that we get ourselves in a bigger mess. So words matter when you get on this kind of thing in a huge way, and you're absolutely right in that this has huge implications in a state like ours when people all the time say, oh yeah, you can go down there in that fishing land, you can go down there. I mean, people do that based on a statute that we're about to muck with. And liability issues are huge. So I guess I would request that you broaden your discussion of this to other groups, maybe fishing, hunting groups, people who generally use this to make sure that we're not doing a quick fix because of one lawsuit and instead opening a can of worms bigger and badder than we could possibly imagine. I see great danger there in terms of our liability law. And you're right, we're kind of left in limbo land now, so if we're going to land somewhere, I'd like to be sure that we're landing on language that's really going to help and not just cause some further upset. One other question. After that lecture, that list you gave of recreational list, was that statutory?
It was.
What's the reference? I need to go back and read that, because, boy, that seems like I'm getting nods up here. Oh, man, can I drive a truck through some of the holes in that? What's the reference?
It's a definition. It's in ORS 105-672, subsection 5.
Thank you. And thanks for bringing this. I mean, you're right. In my heart, I hope a simple fix will solve it. But in my experience, has been that that's not necessarily in a special session, a simple little wording change. Oh, problem solved.
Oops. Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, if I may, we intend to have communication. We have already had it with a bunch of people that we know to have an interest in this issue. And we'll cover the areas that we can, all those that we can find and that we know about.
And I appreciate that effort, because there's a lot more at stake than just...
Yes. Representative Garrett.
Mr. Chair, I was just going to, on that same theme, our Land Use Committee last session heard a similar bill, a bill on a similar topic of adjacent landowner liability. That was a difficult hearing just to get our heads around the issue. I think that came from the League of Cities, and it ended up not passing. And I believe I've read that the City of Portland is looking at a concept that would relate to some of these similar concerns with respect to some trail networks in the city and how that affects landowners. So there is a thicket of issues here that I think need fuller hearing before we just take action on one concept.
Any other questions? Yes, David.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate you bringing this issue to our attention and your cogent description of the LC. Has your organization or a sponsoring legislator sought a legal opinion? I understand that the State Supreme Court's decision was ambiguous in its implications, but I'm curious if we have any legal basis for, you know, the proposed solution.
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, we had a lot of lawyers working on this.
Oh, that helped.
I like lawyers.
And it did include the Department of Justice.
I will tell you that from my perspective, this is an important bill to have a conversation about. I'm not sure that we'll get to the answer in a short session, but I think it really needs to be discussed. I know that from perspective of some of our county people, it's whether they want to have any parks anymore and whether they just want to sell them to private people and let them go. I mean, they've had those kind of conversations because they don't want the liability. And they do want to, if they're going to have them, they need to be able to charge. And one of the issues was, well, would this apply if I pay for parking? Do I lose all my immunity for the whole park? You know, if I have a day use fee, is that done for everything? I mean, it opens a very, very large deal for counties, cities, I would expect, for all of those people, including private landowners, and whether they want to use it. And I think there was a purpose behind the original legislation, because we do have a lot of people who like to use the outdoors and recreate, and it has... It has become a part of what Oregon does, and I think this has the potential, because of the being unsure, to back everything out. And everybody just says, look, not around here. Go someplace else. Go find it. Have your own property. Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would echo some of the concerns about whether when we pull a string, we inadvertently create an outcome that we weren't intending. And I think that's worth paying attention to. However, I'm not sure I'd join with anyone who suggests we have to wait until we can answer the complete question before we make any move. Because if we do that, we'd never make any move at all. And I think we can solve a piece of a problem if we can succinctly do that and leave additional consideration for other ramifications or ancillary issues to another session. I don't think we have to be paralyzed just because we can't solve the entire problem of liability on land.
Representative Burke.
Mr. Chair, I didn't mean to imply that we shouldn't do, okay. I think what I was suggesting is that I want to hear that there's been a broader conversation between than just one park and one county. That the implications for this are greater. So if we're going to pull that string, let's see who else is going to shake when we pull it going in.
Yeah. Any further questions? I guess my overriding comment with respect to all the hearings today is that this is the first time we've actually done this kind of thing, kind of getting ready for this special session. I hope that having these earlier conversations will lead to bigger conversation for the next 2 weeks so that we can maybe find some answers to things and move them forward during the special session. Without having done this, I think there is no hope for a lot of stuff to have a chance during a session because it takes so long to get the conversations going amongst the right people who need to get there. And I think the one thing that's come out in this hearing clearly is that from all the members here, pointing to the people out there, get together with the right groups and try to figure out how we move this if they think they need to move something. And I really appreciate that opportunity for this session, different from last session. And I think that's a good thing for us to see how we move forward. So, and I thank you for bringing this forward. And I know that a number of people talked to me about this one, are very concerned and didn't know what they wanted to do or how they wanted to do it. At least now we can have a conversation. And I would hope that we would talk, make that a big tent with regard to who we talk to that has been said here before. Okay. Thank you very much. That pretty much takes care of the business that we had planned for today, unless anybody has anything else they would like to bring up or talk about. Over the next week or so, if there's other bills that haven't been assigned, they'll probably be assigned to the committees. We'll figure out where we're going to go forward as we get closer to the session. I appreciate the efforts that were made by different members of this committee to get bills introduced. Some of which will come here. So, Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, are these the only bills that have so far been definitively assigned? Are there other?
I think this is the only ones that have been definitively assigned. I've heard of a couple others that may, and I looked around and they haven't gone anywhere, so they may still be coming this way.
Okay.
But these are the ones that have definitively been assigned to the Rules Committee, as we speak right now.
We can handle all of this.
Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Am I to assume that LC 158 is going to be possibly considered in somewhere along the line with House Bill 3633?
Yes.
Yeah, 3638.
Yeah, that's why I put them together today.
Okay.
There may be parts of whichever, but I really do think that that conversation will be a part of what we do.
Okay, thank you.
Any other comments or things for today? If not, we will first close the hearing on LC 179, and then seeing no further business, we will end our Rules Interim Committee. Thank you very much.
All right.